Thank you all for coming today. Welcome you to Kirkland, downtown City Hall, and appreciate you coming out on a Saturday, sharing your time with us and finding out what's going on within the city. My name is Paul Stewart. I'm the Deputy Planning Director for Kirkland. Also like to thank, is Norm here? There's Norm. Kirkland Alliance of Neighborhoods and Norm Storm suggested this topic. We've done this a couple of times. Neighborhood University, Growth Management 101. And we find it's really helpful to find out some background on what is planning, what is growth management, how it applies to Kirkland in our future. We adopted a comprehensive plan about 20 years ago in compliance with the state recently enacted, or enacted at the time, Growth Management Act in 1990-1991. And now we're looking at another 20-year horizon to 2035 and trying to figure out what we want to be over the next 20 years. I'm reminded of something that Casey Stengel, former baseball player and futurist, said, never make predictions, especially about the future. And planners, you know, love to think about the future. And that's kind of a mystery to a lot of people. So here to kind of lay out some secrets and some ideas on how we deal with that is Joe Tovar. Joe is a well-respected practitioner and expert in planning and growth management. He is a former city planning director for the city of Shoreline and here in Kirkland from 1982 to 1992. He was appointed by the governor to serve on the state growth management hearings board. He writes a column for Municipal Research, and he is also an affiliate associate professor at the College of Built Environment with the University of Washington. So take it away, Joe.
Thanks, Paul. You picking me up on this? Thank you. Well, I think John Denver said it best. Gee, it's great to be back home. I've never really been far away from Kirkland since I left, working in downtown for the state for about 12 years, a year and a half down in Covington, 6 years over in Shoreline. I live in Edmonds. Paul forgot to mention I'm now a consultant. So I get to talk to people in lots of other places. I've been down to Lacey, down to Vancouver, up to Everett, up to Island County, up to Bellingham. And a lot of places I travel, people know about Kirkland. They want to know about how did Kirkland do what it did. And a large part of what Kirkland did is it attribute to the people in this room, to the citizens of the city, to the elected officials you put in office, to the planning commissioners who put in long hours sorting through the crystal ball that staff brings to you, and taking a lot of input from a lot of people, a lot of facts, a lot of ideas, a lot of opinions. So kudos to you. You've done a great job. And I'm happy to come back and talk about the bigger picture, planning in general. Where did it come from? Comprehensive planning, zoning, where did that come from? Kind of lay the stage a little bit here for what did the state do and what are the expectations the state might have about the update you're about to take on here. So I'll talk a bit about big picture, zero in on the state, talk a little bit about history, talk about things you've done here in Kirkland recently and are doing now and on into the future. And we'll get underway here with the ultimate big picture, which is the planet. Obviously, we don't get to plan the planet, but we're affected by what goes on at a global scale. Climate change, obvious implication, greenhouse gas emission, vehicle miles traveled, all those things are things that factor into state laws, regional plans, local actions, personal individual decisions people make. Obviously, there are global economic trends at work you read about, know about. Those have impacts on us here in this region and even on you here in this city. This is a fascinating picture. It shows where every light bulb in America was the night this picture was taken. It's a good indication of where the population centers of the country are. Obviously, you can recognize the Eastern Seaboard. I think this is Dallas. I think that's Houston. Of course, here we are in the upper left-hand corner. Now, one comment we made about this is that obviously we're apart from the rest of the country. You have to really want to be here to get here. Take some time, take some resources. And most people who wind up in this corner of the country are here for a reason. It's not an accident that you're here. Can I have a show of hands? How many of you were born in this state? So obviously, many of you came from somewhere else. Conscious decision to be here. A conscious decision to be even in this city. So, historical context. Where did planning and zoning come from? What was the first building code? Anybody got any nominations for where the first building code came from?
New York City.
That's a good guess.
Hammurabi.
Hammurabi. Code of Hammurabi. What was the first rule of the Code of Hammurabi? If you build a building and it falls down and kills somebody, you die. So that's a little beyond the code enforcement capabilities of, hopefully, of today's planning departments. But idea of building cities, building community is ancient, been around for a long time. And a lot of the concepts you hear about these days about human scale, pedestrian orientation, walkability, those are not new either. They're ancient. But remembering them and applying them with technology, with the expectations and the needs of today, is what makes places like Kirkland as successful as you are. So where did zoning come from? It came from the federal government. There was a Supreme Court case in 1926, Village of Euclid, Ohio versus Ambler Realty Company, where the US Supreme Court said, yes, local government, a city, can create a planning ordinance, can create a zoning ordinance, can regulate the use of land. Now there it was very narrowly, we don't want to have factories next to houses, so we're going to use a map to separate those things. So that was very groundbreaking in planning and regulation in this country. In the 1930s, the federal government decided, wow, this is something we should really help the states consider to create state laws to govern these things, to tell people how to plant, how to zone, kinds of things to think about. So the federal government at the time, in the early 30s, had a commerce secretary you might recognize. Anybody recognize this fella? It's Herbert Hoover. So Herbert Hoover, not known for being one of the more radical left-wing visionaries of the day, I think is a good person to make the point. It made good business sense to plan. It made good business sense to regulate. It made good business sense to make investments in infrastructure. So this is really the headwaters of all the state laws in the country. In the 30s, virtually every state adopted that model planning enabling law. Basically, it said, we're enabling you cities and counties. If you want to have a plan, you may. If you want to have zoning, you may. If you want to have your zoning and permit decisions consistent, you may. It didn't require it. It was like a model ordinance. It said, here's how you might do this. So virtually every state, as I said, adopted that in the 30s. Starting in the 70s, a number of states started doing more under the heading of what I would call growth management of some type or form, starting with Oregon back in 1974. They just celebrated the 40th anniversary of their state law. And other states followed with different versions of growth management. And by that term, I mean more than a passive role by the state. So the state was not just enabling, the state actually had some role. And depending on how rigorous that role was, how directive that role was the difference between these 10 different states that have some version of growth management. So the people at the extreme end were the most top-down, most centralized, Hawaii, which has state land use planning. Every scrap of ground in Hawaii is zoned by the state. Vermont, a very small state, very strong. State imposes zoning regulations. For large states, Oregon is the best example of a very centralized, very top-down system. Washington probably is behind that in some ways. And then these other states have bits and pieces. They don't have the entire suite of goals and requirements that we have in this state, but they have pieces. So when somebody says, isn't our system a bottom-up system as opposed to a top-down system? Well, everything is relative. Compared to these planning-enabling states, and there are a lot of them, this is a more top-down system because there is a state role, mandates, and some appeal process, some enforcement process. But compared to, let's say, Oregon or Hawaii or Vermont, this is more bottom-up. So it's somewhere between those two extremes. So why did the legislature adopt this statute back in the early 90s? What difference has it made? So I'll start here with population and growth that was happening. And see, back in 1980, the state population was a little over 4 million. 10 years later, 4.86. It's an increase of about 18%. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of change. That manifested itself in many ways, in traffic congestion, and loss of farmlands, and loss of environmentally critical areas, the cost of housing, and a lot of frustration about what's the role of a city, what's the role of a county, who's on first. You can't tell me what to do, I'm the county. You can't tell me what to do, I'm the city. A lot of conflict, a lot of litigation. Not as much cooperation and collaboration as you might think. So that's a real quick overview of the situation that happened in the decade of the 80s leading up to the adoption of the Growth Management Act. During the decade of the 90s, the first decade of the act, population rate increased. We went from 4.8 to 5.8, a million people, about another 21% of population. Now, I wouldn't argue that the Growth Management Act caused the increase in population. Other things, economic factors, global factors, national factors, drove that increase. Demographic factors drove that increase. Then from about 2000 to today, it's flattened out a little bit. About 14% increase in population, but still, that's a lot of people. In fact, at the depth of the recession, the state of Washington was still the sixth fastest growing state in the country, seventh greatest increase in absolute terms. So compared to other states, this is a place where people want to be, where business wants to be, where young people want to be, where some retirees want to be. If you're a fan of wildfires or hurricanes or tornadoes, you might want to be somewhere else. And then the future. Out to the year 2040, State Office of Financial Management has made forecasts. And the farther out in the future you go, the softer some of these estimates or projections get. So what they've done is they've created a range. They're saying at the high end, by the year 2040, we might have a state of 10.7 million. The low end, over 7 million. 8.8 is the midpoint there. So there will be an increase. The trend line is up. How steep the trend line is you can argue about. But there are more people coming. There are more jobs coming. There's more growth. And there's more change. So the future doesn't bring growth. It brings change. State of Washington, smallest state west of the Rockies in the continental United States in land area. Second largest state in terms of absolute population. West of the Rockies. This is a dense state. There's a lot going on here. But as you can see from this image, they were not evenly distributed throughout that state. There's a lot of focus here in the Central Puget Sound region as an example. This is about 60% of the people, more than that in terms of employment as a share of the state as a whole, but less than 10% of the land area. 82 cities, 4 counties, I don't know how many hundreds of special districts, all cheek by jowl. Same housing market, same job market, many of the same watersheds. So there's a lot in common within this metropolitan region compared to other parts of the state. There are other concentrations elsewhere in the state. When you put these 5 regions together, you have like 95% of the living souls in the state of Washington. So why was the act adopted? What difference has it made? This is just a quick summary of 5 points. I could talk for a long time about all the pieces of the Growth Management Act. There are many pieces to it. But I'm just going to hit a couple of the highlights. One is that before the Growth Management Act, how far a city could go and annex into the countryside wasn't really fixed. There was no state law telling you that. There might have been county policies, but there was no absolute legal limit on how far suburbanization could go out into the countryside. The word here is sprawl. After the Growth Management Act, there was a stop to sprawl. Key feature here was the requirement that urban growth areas be designated. Everything within the state of Washington is one of 5 types. Either it's urban, or it's rural, or it's agricultural resource lands. You notice these long, these are river valleys. This is where the rich soil is. Or they're forest. Lots of this is federal land, but it's productive forest land. Or it's a mineral resource land. Quarries, gravel pits. There is no sixth thing. Everything is one of these 5 things. That's different than prior to the GMA. That's different than in 48 other, or at least 40 other cities in the country. So we don't have sprawl in the classic meaning of sprawl, of not knowing where the city ends and where something else starts. For the Growth Management Act, as I said, there was a lot of competition, conflict between cities and counties because it wasn't clear who was supposed to be doing what. Counties had the legal authority to do everything that cities did. After the act, and I'll talk about this in a second, it was much clearer. What should the city be doing? What should the county be doing? What was the purpose in life of special districts? There was a report done by the legislature in 1989 with this title, and it was looking at this question of why do over half the people in the state of Washington not live in a city? In 1989, the answer was because many of you lived in. Anybody here from Rose Hill? Anybody here from Juanita? Kingsgate? areas that were urbanized under the authority of county, facilitated by special districts for certain minimum urban services like sewer and water. This was a problem. The legislature identified this is an issue. There's a bunch of problems here. One is lack of coordination between the services that are provided and the people who have control for land use, lack of accountability. You have one set of elected officials for the county, one for the water district, one for the sewer district, one for the hospital district, one for the mosquito abatement district, whatever district you might be in. There really is no clear line of accountability and responsibility. So back in 89, right before the GMA was adopted, they were saying, we need to figure out who should be doing what. We need to have some role clarification here. And that's one of the things that the Act did. It clearly states, when it comes to providing urban governmental services, water, sewer, police, local parks, building, planning, local planning, those are services that should be primarily provided by cities, not by counties, not by special districts. The role of counties is also spelled out in the statute, and the role of a county now is to act as a regional government for purposes of figuring out where is the urban growth boundary going to be and how much population must each city account for in its plan, how much employment, how much population. Before GMA, nobody could tell the city how much to plan for. Under GMA, the county does tell the cities that. The county, in turn, gets that number collectively from the state, and it's a 20-year forecast. So the premise, major premise of the GMA is growth is going to happen. We need to plan for it. We need to forecast it. We need to accommodate it. We need to serve it. And since the Act was adopted, how many of you voted to annex to the city of Kirkland at some point in your recent past? Congratulations. You're part of that segment of people who used to be unincorporated urban areas who are now in a city. So now that 64% of the cities, I'm sorry, of the population of the state, was in a city. Loss of farmland is not unique to us in this state. It's been going on in this country for decades. Farmers, agricultural lands, cannot compete with real estate values as either residential or some kinds of commercial. This is the Green River Valley, the Kent Valley. This is at Algona, looking north. So there's the valley, valley floor. Very rich agricultural soil, a lot of agriculture back in the 40s. By the 60s, well, this should say 60s, sorry, this is what's here now. It's no longer agriculture. The Growth Management Act was saying was counties, you need to designate lands that are useful for agricultural production and for forestry production, and you need to adopt regulations to protect them from conversion to non-resource land uses. Without these provisions in the Act, eventually, the Sammamish Valley, the Snohomish Valley, the Snohomish Valley, the Stillaguamish Valley, the Skagit Valley, you name it, all of those would have been subject to the same kind of pressures, if not the same fate, as what happened to the Kent, the Green River Valley. Before the Growth Management Act, there was a lot of disinvestment in downtowns, the cities, especially in this region. Some money was being spent to build new buildings here, to make new business starts here, but not like what's been going on for the past 20 years. How many of you can remember what downtown Renton was like 20, 25 years ago? Did it look like it does now? No. Kent? No. Burien? Very different. I did my master's thesis on downtown Burien back in the 70s. nothing at all like that. So the point is, one of the things the Act has done is to say we want to focus growth and development where we have infrastructure, where we have facilities, where we have transit uses, or opportunities at least. And I think this is a series of successes. This is just six of many, and Kirkland, I think, is right at the top of the list. We interviewed for a job as a consultant in Lacey. They wanted to know all about how you did what you did. I had some ideas about that, but my point is, your reputation is well known far afield. It's a great place to live. People who have done a good job of planning your community. Another thing that I think is kind of subtle, people maybe don't realize, is that there are a number of major regional capital facilities that have been designed, permitted, and built in the last 20 years that would have taken a lot longer, would have been a lot more expensive, or may never have been built without Growth Management Act provisions that say if you have an essential public facility and it defines those cannot be vetoed by the local government. Now, this was a little bit of a stretch for cities. I was there on behalf of the Association of Washington Cities negotiating some of these things back in the early 90s. They were not crazy about the idea of we can't tell somebody you can't put that facility here. On balance, though, they understood Everybody needed the airport. Everybody wanted trans to be built. The treatment plant had to be sited somewhere, and that decision couldn't be made solely by the Snohomish County Council, the Tukwila City Council, the Des Moines City Council. So these provisions say you, local governments, may permit these things. You may have a permit process. You may review them. You may subject them to environmental review. You may impose conditions within reason. But you can't say no third runway, no light rail line, no sewer treatment plant. And all these things obviously have been built and are operating now. So focusing on Kirkland, here come the bouquets, get ready. I've said this several times. You've got a well-deserved reputation as a place that knows how to plan. You're all living here, doing business here for a reason. Before I got here, in the mid-70s, the city became the first city on Lake Washington to adopt a Shoreline Master Program. In 77 was the year that we adopted a consolidated comprehensive plan for the cities of previously Houghton and Kirkland together, a joint comprehensive plan and zoning code, including a number of innovations such as planned areas. We may have encountered planned areas. One through, what number are you up to now, Paul? 20 some odd. You go to most cities, they don't have something called a planned area. They have probably 7 or 8 or 10 zones, and everything's got to be painted with one of those brushes, which is it's like paint by numbers, as opposed to the kind of fine mesh regulating, planning, thinking you can do with a tool like a planned area. 82, new zoning code was adopted by the city, award-winning. Most of these things won awards, one kind or another. 89, annexation of Rose Hill and Lower Juanita. By informed consent, that meant you, the voters of those areas, had to make that decision. It wasn't the city going out and grabbing this land. 1990, I heard somebody mentioning earlier the Juanita Village project. The planning for that goes back to 1990. It took a lot longer than that to build, ultimately. And some of it, I think, is still under construction now. And in 1992, downtown design guidelines were adopted. And I understand the city has since then applied design guidelines to many of your commercial districts. So before you even adopted your first GMA comprehensive plan, you were written up in the media as the people that know how to do it. This is the University of Washington study that was done, came up with what it calls Kirkland as the top suburb. And what they meant by that was you had a compact, complete, connected pattern of land use and facilities and parks and trails. In fact, some of the text of this article talks about if everybody did what Kirkland is doing, the world would be a better place. But much of what you were doing, you did before growth management because you thought it was a good thing to do. And in many ways, best practices for how to do many of these things is what people look to Kirkland to know and learn about. So your first GMA comprehensive plan was adopted in 1995. First phase of Juanita Village began construction 13 years after the city did its plan. So it took a while. There's a couple of lessons here, one of which is don't be impatient. Give your plan time to work. If nothing's going on, there might be a reason for it, like the market. Doesn't mean you should never touch your plan again. It's in a serving binder for a reason. You can amend it because you want to, not because the state's obliging you to. But good case in point. Sometimes things just take a while to ripen. 2003 did a very effective community conversation outreach program to write the vision for the comprehensive plan for your first update, which you then did a couple of years later. Your first major comprehensive plan update was because of a mandate by the state to review your plan and your regulations. 2010, you were the first jurisdiction on the state to adopt an updated Shoreline Master Program. So again, you see a theme here? You just don't adopt these things and forget about them forever. There's a cycle, you come back to these. And again, same theme. Annexation, you finished the job in 2011 of making the entire Kirkland community part of the city of Kirkland. And just recently, you've acquired the rights to the old Burlington Northern Railroad right-of-way for the Cross Kirkland Corridor. Major accomplishment, hats off to you. Now the hard work starts, figuring out what to do with it. Okay, now, how does what you do here in Kirkland fit into the big picture of state law? You've heard about Vision 2040, which is a regional strategy adopted by the Puget Sound Regional Council, which is the four counties, the 82 cities sitting as a federation of decision makers. And how does your comprehensive plan get implemented? How does it manifest itself on the ground when you see projects being built or public improvements being made? So to explain these two things, I'm doing it all on one slide. Get ready. After this is over, we'll make a copy of this slide if you want to look at this. But this is like an advent calendar. I'm going to unfold it a piece at a time, because if I gave you the whole thing, it would just blow your hair straight back. Comprehensive plan. Everybody has a comprehensive plan. Even those other 40 planning enabling states, they have a comprehensive plan. What's in their comprehensive plan? Their vision. And by that I mean their values, their preferences, their priorities, how much they want to provide this service or that service, how much they're willing to pay for this service or that service. Local choice. Then there are state laws. In the case of Washington, we have this new act, going on 22 years old now. And it provides inputs, many goals, many requirements, too numerous to name right now, but lots of input to how you do your plan. For example, your plan must be internally consistent. All these chapters have to work together. It also creates regional policies, countywide planning policies, which I mentioned this earlier. Now the county, working with the cities, comes up with population targets for each of the cities and employment targets for each of the cities. That is an input to each city's comprehensive plan. You can try and influence that number, and I think the city has been involved in those discussions, but once you get that number, that's the number you have to accommodate in your plan. The good news is you get to decide specifically where, how much, at what density, at one form, with one character, with what facilities. A lot of details are still your choices. Another Growth Management Act creature that's a regional policy is Vision 2040. It's actually called a multi-county planning policy. And it provides direction both to the county plans and to the city plans. I'll talk more about that in a little bit, but it's also an input to every comprehensive plan in the region, not just in the county. Okay, so now you've got your plan, not quite done yet. There's also a Shoreline Management Act that I mentioned earlier. It provides inputs into your comprehensive plan. There's a chapter in your plan that talks about policies within 200 feet of the high water line of the lake and streams, I believe. So now you've got your policy document. This is your chart for the future. So the question becomes, well, how do we implement this? There are a couple of different ways that you do that. One is your plan provides direction to your regulations. The regulations include zoning, subdivision, buildable lands, could be also shoreline regulations. Important to understand that regulations control how land is used. Plans do not. Plans control what regulations. But you cannot apply a plan directly to a permit. You need to apply a regulation to a permit. And those have to be internally consistent as well. Continuing down to the bottom of the chart here, permits. So when somebody issues a permit, whether it's a zoning permit, a subdivision permit, a building permit, a grading permit, whatever kind of permit you might have, that's got to be consistent with the applicable regulation, which has to be consistent with whatever the plan says that's on point, which has to be consistent with state law and regional policy. So this is the hierarchy that exists for policy. Now, regulation and permit is not the only way that your plan gets implemented. There are a couple of other important ways, one of which is your capital budget, public projects. And public projects include things like roads, parks, public buildings, water systems, sewer systems. Those are all spelled out by the city with financing methods, with levels of service, with lots of maps and indications of what's going to be built where, when, to what design standard. But again, those are things that have got to be described in the capital facilities piece of your comprehensive plan. So there's a connection back to this broad policy document for public projects that get built. There also are other things that the city might do that don't fit neatly under the heading of either a capital project or regulation on a private permit. And that could be many things. That could be annexation policies, it could be local tax policies, it could be volunteer programs, things like IV out programs or stream keepers, things that might embody and bring to reality things you talk about in your comprehensive plan, but that aren't regulations and aren't projects. So this is pretty much the universe of what happens on the ground. People see this happening in their neighborhoods, but if you go upstream, you can see where the policy direction for all these things comes from. Other important thing to say here, I got one more. thing to add here, State Environmental Policy Act, SEPA, been around for 40 years. And certain actions the government might take, like issuing a permit or adopting a plan, are subject to environmental review. Anything on this list I've shown you that is defined as an action, you've got to do SEPA on that as well. So that's the final state law I'll make reference to here. But while this is up on the screen, everybody's hair appears to be where it was when they first sat down. So it looks like you can absorb all this. It takes some time. But the other thing to grasp from what I've shown you here is that because of this hierarchy of policy and direction, this is the time to get involved. This is the time to get involved. There's more discretion for the city to make choices up here than there is down here. There's more opportunity for your elected officials to be influenced by what you have to recommend to them up here. And they have choices that they can make up here. By the time you get down here, it's much more constrained, much, much narrower. So you're here at the right time. Okay, who knows what this is? It's a river, but it's the Mississippi River. Mile wide at places. And I use this as a metaphor for comprehensive planning process. You come down the river, you're going from Minneapolis down to the Gulf of Mexico, you're going one direction. But it's a big, wide river. Where you choose to be in the river is your business. There's a lot of choice in how you do this. Having said that, there are some banks to the river. You need to stay away from the banks. You need to watch out for the sandbars and the snags. And GMA terminology, that would mean things like, well, what if we decide we don't want to let the public tell us what they think and we're just going to adopt this plan without them? No, you're going to run aground. You have to have early and continuous public involvement in the preparation of your plan. Now, the city's obviously not going to do something like that, but when I was on the growth board, we had a couple of jurisdictions that missed that step. Usually, it was a matter of making a last-minute change. After a long planning commission process, they'd say, well, this doesn't quite fit. We'll make this change. Well, the public didn't have a chance necessarily to know about that change or comment on that change. They went aground. They were sent back. Do it again. Give the public a chance to say what they think. Okay, fine. We'll do this. Another example is concurrency. You have to adopt level of service for transportation systems. You have to be able to measure performance. If somebody comes in and applies for a permit that violates your level of service, you're prohibited from issuing that permit. So that's another snag. City of Bellevue, when I was on the board, anybody from Bellevue here? Well, they may be watching at home. Their council decided that concurrency was kind of getting in the way of redevelopment of a shopping center, so they adopted an ordinance exempting shopping centers below 10 acres from concurrency. That was appealed, came to the board. We said, you don't get to do that. You've got to have a way to measure performance of that system. Now, you can set that level of service wherever you want. You have complete discretion to do that, how you measure it. You have a lot of choice there, but you do not get to say, we're just going to basically exempt ourselves from a requirement of the act. That's a sandbar. That's a snag. But again, the good news is there's a lot more discretion and choice between the pars of the river than there is out at the edges. Okay, where do your choices get manifested in your comprehensive plan? These are the chapters or elements the state says you have to have in your plan. I think I've captured all the plan elements you have in Kirkland here. You've got a couple of optional elements that you have chosen to include in your plan. You may do that, but it's subject to all the goals and requirements and process of the GMA, the same as the required elements. Now, there's two elements that are missing here. One is the transportation element, which I understand in Kirkland, you're going to be using your update of the transportation master plan to provide both technical and then some policy decisions that would then live in this part of your comprehensive plan. Likewise, there's a parks and recreation PROS plan that is underway, and I guess people can talk about that today at one of the stations in City Hall, that eventually will manifest itself in some policy choices and directions, preferences, that will live in this part of your comprehensive plan. And finally, there also is a requirement that you have a future land use map showing people what's going to be where, what uses, what intensity, what density. Those are all choices you can make locally about what your plan says. Here it is. Thank you. So this is basically what is within the boundaries of your comprehensive plan. And that's the choice you get to make. Now, I mentioned Vision 2040 was adopted, I think, 2 years ago. And what it did was to look out to the year 2040 and say, by the year 2040, a couple of things. One is we're going to look out beyond the 20-year life of a comprehensive plan. So although you're planning for a Kirkland 2035, there are 5 years beyond that that the regional plan contemplates. And one of the things that it contemplates is that within that 27 years, the urban growth boundary, which is this heavy green line, I'm calling it the metropolitan urban growth boundary because there are some rural cities out beyond it, like Snoqualmie and so on, that line's not going to move. Matter of policy, the region has said that line's not going to move. Matter of policy, the county has said that line's not going to move. It's not going to move in a big way. At the same time, forecast is another 1.2 million jobs, 1.4 million people. Do the math. What this means is this is going to be a more dense metropolitan area. More people, more jobs, more trips, more traffic, more congestion, more annoyance, more nuisance, more lawsuits, more need to plan. To try to plan around, to deal with, soften as many of those impacts as you can. Because if you don't, it would be a lot worse. So Vision 2040 is important because what it says about the future of the region, what we expect to see in terms of job growth and employment growth, it also shows these red dots, centers. Everett's a center, Bellevue's a center, Seattle's a center. These are metropolitan centers. There's five of them. Everett, Bellevue, Kirkland, Bremerton, Tacoma. And then there are these smaller centers, which are also supposed to be focal points for employment and housing. You have one here in Totem Lake. And there are four of them, actually, on the east side. Redmond, Overlake, Bellevue. So a major premise of the regional plan is growth will be concentrated in centers. Cities get to decide how much and what form that growth takes in those centers. That's part of what you'll be doing with your comprehensive plan. Now, Vision 2040 also builds on much of what the state statute says about urban growth areas, environmental protection of critical areas, conserving farmlands and forest lands, but it also cites human and planetary health reasons for compact development. This is a study that was done by UBC a couple of years ago that actually quantified what many people thought intuitively to be true, which is that the more intensely you use land, the better you serve it with transit, the less greenhouse gas emission is put into the atmosphere. So what is the periodic plan update? What does it mean for you? What should you be thinking about? How can you get involved? Who knows where this guy is? On the Golden Gate Bridge. Which end of the bridge is he at? At the Marin end, the north end. What is this guy going to do when he gets all the way to the north end? He's going to start the south end.
Yeah.
It's a cycle of maintenance. It's not just prettying up the bridge. This is actually protective coating, protect the integrity of the structure. Well, same thing is true of the comprehensive plan. There's an eight-year cycle. So you'll be doing the 2015 update by the middle of 2015, and then 8 years later, you'll be doing it again. And so on and so on and so on. So the good news is you don't have to get the perfect, you know, in year 20 and in year 30 and year 40. Absolutely correct now. You have to do the best you can with what you know, with what's important to you, but you'll have opportunities to update your plan as new things become apparent to you, as new trends become apparent, as new priorities emerge. Your plan is going to change. It's not an inflexible document. This is a slide provided to me by the state of Washington. The Department of Commerce says, comp plan update, it's easy. There are only four steps. Okay, first you come up with a public participation program. How are you going to involve your public? I think the city is already well down the road on preparing one of these. Then you review and revise your comprehensive plan and development regulations. Sounds easy, right? Because then they blow right next to, well, then you take legislative action, which is to say, after about 2 years of work, council will adopt an ordinance saying, this is our updated comprehensive plan. These are the updated regulations to go along with and implement that comprehensive plan. And then they need to send a copy of that notice, that ordinance, to the state for a couple of reasons. Now, the state's going to be talking to you all along the process. They will review drafts. They will answer questions that you might have because Department of Commerce is responsible ultimately for making sure that everybody meets the deadline, that they get the best technical information and potentially some grant money to help do some of this work from the state, and that if something that is prepared for adoption by a city or a county is way over to the side of the river and in the bank, the state could appeal it, and then you could be in front of a hearings board or a court at some point. So there's a reason to pay attention to what the state is saying. They try to be helpful. They have technical expertise. They have some grant money. They also have a duty to make sure that you're staying on time, staying on track with adoption of your plan. Now, what are your targets? I made mention to those. There are targets for all of the cities, 39, I think, at this point. I lose track. Kirkland is a core city, along with 8 other cities in the county. It means you have certain special duties for concentrating growth and development in those places. Your targets for 2035, these are them. They've been adopted. Every city in the county has these numbers. They're different numbers, and there are a bunch of reasons why those numbers are what they are, but this is the number you're working with. Question.
I have a question about this very thing, because we do have targets, and Kirkland's been very good about meeting their targets, yet there are other cities who are close by to us who do not. So what is the teeth in this regulation that would motivate those other cities to step up?
Okay, all the cities are subject to the same requirements that you are. They are all subject to the same targets that are allocated from the county. The Commerce will be monitoring what they're doing. Others may be monitoring what they're doing. At some point, if somebody fails to comply with some requirement of the Act, the recourse is to file an appeal. The Growth Hearings Board make an argument about what section of the law has been violated and why. And then it's basically an administrative law proceeding with attorneys arguing, records being submitted, legal arguments being made back and forth, and then a decision being rendered. Yes, they did comply, or no, they didn't comply, and here's why, with direction then to do something. That's a real broad brush of how the enforcement process works. Most cities get that this is a duty that they have. Most cities understand there are some consequences for noncompliance. One of the consequences of noncompliance is you would become ineligible for certain state grant funds. If what you've done is so egregiously out of whack with what the Act requires or allows, the Growth Board could invalidate the action. That won't work for everything, but for some things, things have been invalidated. And finally, the most extreme consequence is that the governor could impound gas tax funds or other state revenues that come to the city. So there are some teeth. It's, again, this is not Vermont, Hawaii, or Oregon. So it's not that top down, that directive. But there are some duties and there are some consequences for failure to comply. I said earlier, each of you gets to decide how much is going to be in the center, how much is going to be in other parts of the city. Each of you gets to make a lot of decisions about what's it going to look like, how big is it going to be, what's the character of the building, what's the form relative to the street or other properties. Same goes for levels of service. That's police, parks, fire, other kinds of services you might provide. What kind of infrastructure might you need? Roads, parks, trails? What kind of amenities might be needed to accommodate the growth that you're planning for? So these are all the things that live in the plan. This is what the choices and what 2035 is all about. So this is the work plan, as I understand. The city is prepared coming up. This spring and this summer, they're going to be collecting a lot of information and data, land use data, trip data, other kinds of information, and analyzing current conditions. This fall, did I get this right, Paul? This fall, you're going to revisit the vision. You're going to potentially refresh the division. Maybe you're going to refine the division. The vision goes into the comprehensive plan because that's really the direction and the sideboards for everything else that follows. Values is where you start this conversation. So that's what vision will be about this fall. Be identifying issues that you think should be addressed in each of those elements or chapters of the comprehensive plan, whether it's a capital facilities issue or a land use issue or a parks issue or an economic development issue, and talking about what appropriate changes the city might consider. Now, this is an iterative process. You're going to be revisiting some of these decisions and discussions as you move forward through the rest of this process. But then you get up into 2014, and the staff, the commission, the council, the community will be preparing a draft based upon the refined vision, based upon new inputs and information, might be looking at different alternative ways, places to accommodate the growth that's coming. And then in spring of next year, you'll have to do an environmental review. Might be an impact statement. Looks like you made a judgment it will be an impact statement. There will be a disclosure of what would the likely impacts be if these changes are implemented. And then end of 2014, they're giving themselves some lead time here to adopt the final updated plan and code by the end of next year. Now, the absolute deadline is the middle of 2015. My experience with every planning effort I've ever been involved with is it takes longer than you think it will. You need to set targets. You need to be very deliberate about moving forward. You need to avoid backsliding. And yet, it takes the time it takes. So thank you very much. Good luck to you all. I'll answer any questions now you might have.
Anybody have any questions for Joe?
You sound like a place you know?
So I really like City of Kirkland. We've lived here for a few years, and I just have a question. If we have been so award-winning in our planning and so forth, what does the City of Kirkland have against sidewalks?
Well, I probably can't answer that as well as the staff could. You're not alone. Many places want to have sidewalks. What part of town do you live in?
Houghton.
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 Sorry, yeah. I work in Houghton and live in Highlands.
Okay. So I would encourage you to walk down and talk to the Public Works Department. They're the ones that deal with sidewalks, and they have a booth set up. So
I would also encourage them to get involved in your neighborhood association, because we had two different times that we looked at sidewalks and putting a sidewalk bond on. That while a lot of people want sidewalks, and I'm one of them, there's also a lot of people who don't. And so the city has been very good about trying to weigh the two together. So get involved in your neighborhood association. She's your chair, right here.
The best time to make sidewalk improvements are when the land is subdivided or built. Retrofitting neighborhoods after the fact is very difficult. You've got geometries to figure out. You've got different priorities for people who are already living there. And it's expensive. But if it's a priority for the city, they can make sidewalks a priority.
Other questions?
Yeah, you talk about the different elements of growth management, and one of my big concerns is fire and police are dependent on, and even parks are dependent on voter approval. Mm-hmm. Well, right now, there's quite a bit of development planned in the downtown area of Kirkland that would require a certain amount of fire and police if there was an emergency. But I feel that we might overplan, and at a future time, the voters won't approve the necessary funding for fire and police, mm-hmm. and that overplanning will cause a crisis.
Well, I guess a couple things to be said. One is that the Growth Management Act says that in the cap facilities element, the city has to talk about facilities. So in terms of fire and police, it would be public safety buildings, might be rolling stock of equipment. I think Snohomish County has done that. But the Growth Management Act doesn't require the city in this comprehensive plan to talk about its operating budget, which mainly is personnel, and maintenance even of facilities. GMA doesn't require you to talk about that in your comprehensive plan. Now, just because the act doesn't make you do it, doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. No. I think if the city chose to, it could make those connections in its comprehensive plan, make the connections back to, can we afford this level of service? How are we going to fund this? If we can't, what adjustments do we make to the level of service or to the facilities improvements that we think we can make? Because there's got to be adequacy of facilities to support the land use. But the city council ultimately gets to decide what is adequate, and they can dial that up or down as they see fit. One thing I think I probably should reinforce at this point is the city council is the ultimate authority adopting everything the act requires, comprehensive plans and regulations. Council has exclusive discretion to do that. They do have a duty, though, consider, that's the word in the statute, consider all the input from all the citizens. People have to be given a reasonable opportunity to say what you think of all these choices. Council has to think about that, and then they get to do what they think is the right thing to do. So there's a duty to listen, but not a duty to agree.
Yes.
I really appreciate you doing the background, too, and how mm-hmm. the plans come together. I'm also wondering, then, from the state down to county, down to city level. I've been a consultant as well in my life, and sometimes when you plan, you only plan for one vision. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in any of the planning that says contingency? So if X happens, this is what input Y could be? And the reason I ask that is because of risk. So mm-hmm. anything a plan wants to depend on has to do with money to do it. And we've mm-hmm. all seen in the last few years that we've had to vote on, do you want to permanently increase something because we're way behind? Mm-hmm. So is there anything in any statewide, county, and city planning that says also have a contingency?
Well, I don't believe it's characterized quite that way, except there has been some case law that says if you set a level of service, which you're required to do for transportation facilities, you're not absolutely required to do that for other facilities, although many people do, and you, for whatever reason, can't meet that level of service, you do have a duty to go back and adjust your plan so that you can meet that level of service. Worst case scenario, somebody says, hey, wait a minute, council, we voted this down 3 times, the money's not coming, you need to change that level of service. And if the council, for some reason, were not to do that, I think that that's a cause of action for an appeal. Worst case scenario, though, would be you get in front of the Growth Hearings Board, and the city attorney says, we haven't done this because we choose not to. The worst thing that's going to happen is the Growth Board is going to say, we'll give you 6 months to fix it. Now, we're not going to tell you which way to fix it, either come for the money or change the level of service, but that's your duty. You've got to figure out how you're going to fix it. Then you have 6 months to fix it. Come back in 6 months, it's a compliance hearing. Did you do what was you were directed to do? Yes, we did. Fine. Everything's happy. Go home happy. No, we didn't. Well, then the Growth Board has to think about, are there some other consequences that might flow from that in terms of sanctions? Again, that's a pretty extreme solution. It's only been done once in the 20-year history of the Act. But it comes back to, I think, a lot of the setting of levels of service and making sure they match up with funding is all about truth in planning. I mean, can you really have that level of service if you don't have the money for it? If the answer is no, you need to change that level of service. Over here.
Yeah, lived in Kirkland all my life. I'll tell you, 55 years. My question is, could you address how mixed use and usage of zoning, mixed use, for example, take Juanita Village, and how that serves the master plan for the city of Kirkland specifically, because we don't have a lot of vacant land mm-hmm. in the city of Kirkland, exception of the new annex in Juanita. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues up there because it's on a hill, a lot of steep grades. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be easy to do. Can you address how mixed use is going to serve the obligations of the Growth Management Act here for the city of Kirkland? Thank you.
Sure. Well, mixed use is a choice you can make. Mid-rise buildings, a lot of the images I gave you of those downtowns, typically the economics of construction these days is you can afford to build 4 or 5 stories of wood frame over 1 story of concrete and steel. You go more than 4 or 5 stories, then it's an all-steel structure. It gets to be very prohibitively expensive. So what you see at Juanita Village probably is at the far end of what the market will support. Now, what the rents will support for that form of development, one of the things that's nice about mixed use and that kind of vertical development is it concentrates, provides a lot of opportunity for more housing and or more jobs in a finite amount of land. I mean, your comment that Kirkland is a very developed place, I understand that. Most cities that are inner ring suburbs in the Seattle area are very developed. Edmonds, pretty much built out. But most of what happens in the way of permit activity is when the economic life of how land is developed gets to a point where it then is economic to take those improvements out and put something else in to redevelop. Most of what you see in downtown Kirkland right now wasn't there 30 years ago, but something else was. So it's a natural life cycle and economic cycle of cities that as the economic life of buildings and uses eventually ends, something else, when the market justifies it, something else will happen there. And most of the mixed-use places I can name in places like Renton and Bellevue, and Kent, and Kirkland, but there was something else there for decades before. So I think it's not quite the question you were asking, but I think it's sort of a market reality. Redevelopment happens over time, not just here. It happens that way everywhere.
We have time for a couple more questions.
Could you respond a little bit more about the community involvement part? Obviously, mm-hmm. today is a piece of it, but mm-hmm. you know, we're a small fraction of the Kirkland population. So are there formal other points of input, surveys or whatever?
Well, the city probably has, I don't know if it's on your website yet, all the ways to talk to the city, stay aware of meetings. Sometimes they'll do surveys on site. I think people do Survey Monkey for input. The visioning process is going to be the major opportunity because those tend to be very elaborate, very hands-on. Like, I'm getting ahead of you here on your visioning process. The way you did it last time was award-winning. It was great. In fact, we borrowed that in Shoreline. We did the same kind of process with a lot of meetings throughout the community with the issues framed, with people then invited to say what you think the alternatives ought to be, how you feel about different alternatives, ideas you might have, maybe you haven't thought of for either the city as a whole or for your neighborhood. So that's the major opportunity to get involved, I think, at the visioning process, and then from the vision will come some alternatives for land use and other things that will be commented on. I'm sure there'll be plenty of meetings. Right. Yeah, I think it'll be very difficult not know what's going on if you give them your email address.
Yeah, I think this is the kickoff where we have a number of events planned for the next couple of years, beginning in the fall again, and then a series of workshops, some open houses again, and the webpage is where to go to find out more information and sign up on our listserv. We have a booth down at the very end of Main Street here where we have a number of displays and information tell you about the process and where we're going with the comp plan update. Last question, Karen.
So as our land gets more and more expensive and mm-hmm. we're getting denser and denser, fewer mm-hmm. and fewer people can afford to live here. So I want to know about what the Growth Management Act has to say about providing homes for everybody.
Well, that is a very difficult issue. There is a goal in the act that the city comprehensive plan for every city in every county should provide housing for all segments of the population. That's a pretty ambitious goal. There is a housing element that you're required to have in your plan that talks about how is the city responding to that goal. There also is a target, back to the county and their targets. There's not just an overall population target and an employment target. There also are affordable housing, I don't know if they're still called targets. They used to be called numeric targets, but now they're more aspirational.
Yes.
Where they ask each city in this comprehensive plan to say, regionally we have this need. You know, we're the teachers and the firefighters and policemen and others that are, not as well-to-do. Where are those folks going to live? And talk about that in your comprehensive plan. That could be many different things. It could be at a rental. Some places, I'm working for Everett right now, and their plan, they're thinking about micro units for certain kinds of developments. Lacey's thinking about right-sized parking, which means if you've got a transit center right across the street, do you really need as much parking as if you have a transit center 6 miles away? Whenever you make those kinds of changes, though, you can kind of almost hear the sound of swords coming out of sheaths, because because then you're changing things, and other people's reasonable in their mind expectation about how parking is going to be handled and how it's going to affect them comes into play. So these are not easy issues. I mean, it's kind of a cynical way to describe planning, but basically, I'll say this, I'm not a cynic, but I've heard cynics say this, planning is a process of allocating both benefits and pain. And public policy is about making choices and decisions that will affect everybody, which is why it has to be a very inclusive process of everybody telling the city, ultimately, what you think. But by definition, the public is not going to all agree with each other on every issue. So that's why the council ultimately has to be the final arbiter, saying, on balance, with these mandates from the state law, with all this input from the public, with all these factors and facts that the staff has brought us about what our choices might be, here's our policy decision. Here's what we're choosing. Hope you like it. If you don't, we're sorry. We might revisit some of these things at some point, which is another point. You don't have to wait 8 years to amend the plan or the regulations. You can amend them every year if you wish. So it's a constant process of adjustment.
You can amend every year?
You can amend your comprehensive plan once a year.
Okay, yes, okay, the comprehensive.
You can amend your regulations every month if you want to, since that same limitation doesn't apply to regulations. It's very labor intensive, but my final commercial will be, remember, it's not just a mandate to update your plan, it's a mandate to update your regulations. And what affects what can be built is regulations. So make sure you're paying attention to your regulations. Make sure that they're doing what you need them to do. Don't rely entirely on your plan to do what regulations need to be doing.
So I'd like to thank Joe for being here. He'll be around for a few more minutes. And then...
To find out how you can join the conversation, go to kirklandwa.gov/Kirkland2035.